This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Saturday, June 29th, Hearing Loss Solutions for Veterans will take place from 8:45 to 5:30 at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. It features workshops, panel discussions, and the newest technology. Lunch will be provided. Don't miss Hearing Loss Solutions for Veterans at 8:45 a.m. Saturday, June 29th at the Oregon Convention Center. Pre-register today at hamiltoncaptel.com/veterans.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to A Deeper Look. I'm your host, Linda Olson Osterlund. Thanks to whistleblower Edward Snowden, we're now all aware of the expanded government surveillance inside the United States, and I know that many of you in the KBOO audience already were aware of it. But we're being asked by our government to believe that these capabilities and these activities are necessary for our safety, and to trust that they won't abuse these powers. Now, I think in our listening audience, many of us know you can't trust the federal government. I mean, you certainly can trust individuals, and you can trust certain aspects of things that are done with you. But when it comes to state security, no, you can't trust the federal government. Well, today's topic pulls aside the veil of government secrecy in a particular case, thanks to new information gained through a Freedom of Information Act request. It's the case of Yassin Arif, an Iraqi refugee of Kurdish descent. I first heard about him, last January. I did I guest hosted for More Talk Radio, and I interviewed Trevor Aronson, author of the book The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terror. And that really says it all in terms of what's been being revealed. But this new FOIA takes it to a new level, really reveals the way that our federal government is behaving, and hopefully provides a basis for appeal for Yassin Arif. Today, to get us up to speed on this case and give us actually bring the background of it all to you and tell you about the recent release is volunteer attorney Stephen Downs. I say volunteer because he's pro bono attorney for Yassin Arif and has been for many years. He is a retired chief attorney with the New York Commission on Judicial Conduct, and he's also one of the founders of Project Salaam, support and legal advocacy for Muslims. So welcome to KBOO, Stephen Downs.
Thank you, Linda. It's good to be on.
I'm really glad to have you here. You know, in the book, The Terror Factory, Inside FBI's Manufactured War on Terror, I do recommend people get that so that you can really get a good picture of how this has been operating. This was one of dozens of cases that I read about. So, you know, there are so many different cases of Muslims being arrested and convicted on charges supposedly related to terrorism. Many of us don't realize how many there have been, but this case was very particular, and it was certainly important in Albany, New York. Can you take us back to when you first became aware of the case and give us the history? Who is this gentleman? How did he come to be imprisoned by our federal government?
Sure. We had a big headline sort of hit the paper on August 4th, 2004, that Yassin Arif, who was the imam of a local mosque, had been arrested, and another member of the mosque on charges of terrorism. And I'd heard about the case. The governor got all involved in this thing, sort of said, "Terrorists are living among us." I remember that was the headline, you know, just really to prejudice the jury pool. They went out and they interviewed the whole Muslim community. They just spread fear everywhere they could to sort of set this case up as a really bad terrorist case. And then the evidence began to come out, and there was something really odd about it. It just looked like a weird case. And so since I had just retired as chief attorney at that time, I volunteered to work with the defense team to see what I could do with it. And my assignment was basically to go over and spend a lot of time with Yassin in jail awaiting the trial and to sort of act as a liaison between the firm and Yassin. So I got to know him very well in the 6 months before the trial. And that's so I really got to know a lot about the case, and I realized that this man was innocent. He was completely innocent. And would you like me to explain the sting?
Sure, explain the sting, because they used a sting operation, and it so fell short of anything I would think would have gotten a conviction. But talk about it.
Well, what they essentially did was they got another person in the mosque, and they had a guy that came in who was a professional liar, con man, crook. He'd been convicted of, I think, 68 different felonies. And in exchange for having all of these felonies go away, he agreed to help the federal government by pretending to be an arms merchant. And then he went to this other man in the mosque and said, I am a rich, powerful businessman. I do all of these things. I sell missiles. I make money. I can loan you money from what I'm making is in the missile business.
I also read in this story that his first approach to this was to Hossein, the owner of the pizzeria, who was charged along with Arif, was that he approached gave his children toys.
Oh, yes. This really offended everybody that he was the oiliest person I've ever met. He just oozed charm until you suddenly realize the kind of almost rage underneath it. He's quite an unusual character. I think he was clearly a compulsive liar, a man that is just consumed by his own inability to have an integral personality.
So his name,
brilliant con man.
So, and he's been used in more than one case, and he's been paid by the federal government for his work in these cases. So he approached this pizzeria owner,
right, and offered to loan him money. Now the Yassin, the imam, was always the target of this, and the key question in this entire case was, why was he the key person here?
Why were they even targeting him? There was nothing apparent in any of his behaviors or beliefs.
That's right. But they decided that they needed to approach him through Mohammed Hossein, because the pizza man, because they didn't think that they could get to him any other way. So what they basically did was to set up a situation where the Malik, the government agent, would make a loan to Mohammed Hossein, the pizza guy, and that Arif, the imam, would simply act as the witness, which was the Muslim equivalent of a notary.
And that's very common, that they will use one of the imams as a witness for financial transactions or big things like that.
That's right, routinely done. And the idea was that during the course of these, there are about five or six transactions on five or six different days that were really important, that Malik, the government agent, would drop little hints that the money from the loan was coming from the sale of a missile. And the theory was that if you were the notary, you should know by hearing this conversation in the background while you're notarizing the documents or witnessing the documents, that the loan transaction itself was based on illegal funds, and therefore you were part of the conspiracy. So if for anybody out there, I'm talking to a radio audience who's ever notarized a document, did you ever realize that in the background conversation while you were putting your stamp on the document, if somebody was saying something to suggest that this was illegal, you would be guilty of illegality also? It's a pretty far-fetched theory.
And it's also true that he didn't specifically say that he was doing illegal things. In fact, he would later say, no, this is all legal, and I have licenses to import. He claimed to be importing weapons, and he showed one thing that he thought was a weapon to Hossein or something. But he also said, I have licenses to import this, and I'm shipping it to other places. So he was sort of a master of the ambiguous statement that he could later say to the court meant he was talking about terrorism and sending arms to terrorists. But when you read what he said, you couldn't get that clearly at all.
Absolutely. And he, for example,
and these were all recorded.
Missile, I would say three or four times maybe in Arif's presence, but he always mispronounced it as missile. And Arif didn't speak good English. He spoke very little English. So in a lot of ways, he would always, like at one point, he handed Arif some money and asked him to count it. And while he was counting the money, he made probably the one key statement that would have linked the loan to the sale of a missile. And Arif, you can see, it was all shot on video. He's just counting the money. He's not paying the slightest bit of attention. He never refers to it again. In the entire case, he never referred to anything to show that he was in the slightest aware of any of this plot.
And actually, it wasn't a plot to Hossein either. Hossein was saying, okay, I'll go along with this loan. It's great. I can use the money. But, you know, he actually began to pay the man back, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He was just following this out as a loan, and he was a very loyal American. I mean, he'd come over here as an immigrant many years ago, and he loved America. He thought America was terrific. He would never have done anything to hurt America. This was supposed to be, this whole plot was aimed somehow at a group that was doing bad things in Kashmir.
And so supposedly they were trying to aid a terrorist action in Kashmir. Or
right.
Out of Kashmir.
So from his point of view, he was simply saying, what has this got to do with the United States? I'm just trying to fix up my business. I'm not hurting the United States in any way. Anyway, so that was how it went. And they were eventually convicted. Hossein was convicted of everything, the pizza man. Yassin was actually not convicted of most of the charges. The jury looked at them and decided that he really wasn't involved. He was just simply there as a notary. The last conversation that they had involved a code word. The government loves to throw in code words because it sounds suspicious to the jury and it makes the whole thing look like a conspiracy. So he had worked out this code word with Hossein, the pizza guy, that the word missile was Chowdhury. And so in this last conversation, he says to Yassin, I buy and sell Chowdhury's. I send them to New York. They make money for me. If I get some more money, I can make you a loan. Yassin does not respond to that. But that would have tied the loan together with the missile, if he understood the code word.
And if he understood English and heard missile out of missile.
But I think probably the key point here was that the code word was never explained to him. The government took the position that they had explained the code word to Yassin. But if you actually look at the transcript, they lied about it, and it was quite clear that they later retracted it and said, no, we didn't actually do it that way. There was no credible evidence in the trial that he knew the code word. But nonetheless, it was for the count surrounding that one conversation that he was convicted.
And it's later come out that over and over again around the country, they use similar tactics. They set people up with similar ways. They want to have the exchange of dollars. They want to, pin them down in certain ways on tape so that they can later say, see, they did plan this. They were part of a conspiracy. They meant to do it. Yeah. In this case, they just let the gentleman go for another, 7 months?
Well, the sting went on for seven months, probably a year, actually. We don't really know when it began. But it went on for at least a year.
And they didn't do anything else. They don't accuse the two men of ever having done anything else or have met to talk about things like this or any other activities.
Oh, no. There was never any suggestion that they had initiated. This was entirely initiated by the government right from the beginning. And that's always was the question, and I think I'll get to that in a minute. I just want to say that as a result of this case, we began to find other similar cases all over the country. In Albany, there was an outrage over this case. We felt that this guy had been railroaded and framed. And then we began to find cases all over the country. And that's what started Project Salaam. We wanted to find out how many other cases were there.
Well, talk about this a little bit. I know you're Stephen Downs, and you're an attorney who took this on. Who else in the community decided to get involved in support of these two men around this case?
Right.
Talk about the community response.
Sure. Kathy Callan and May Safar, one was a Muslim, one was non-Muslim, they were neighbors, and they got to talking about the case, and they said, something is wrong here. So they called for a community meeting. And about 50 people showed up. I showed up. Kathy Manley showed up. Quite a number of people showed up. And so we decided to form a group called the Muslim Solidarity Committee to support the families of the two men that were convicted because they had a total of 10 young children and two wives and failing businesses or no business at all. So they were really in bad shape. And so we, over the years, I think we probably raised $70,000 to $80,000 to help the families. And we've tried to become aunties and uncles to all the kids. And
that's one of the most important thing, I'm quite sure, to both the prisoners. And I know for Yassin Arif, I've read comments of his. I mean, both of them were deeply, deeply worried about their families after they were convicted.
Yes. I think, yes, both of them were. And it's been a real labor by all of the people involved. And one of the most touching, profoundly gratifying, satisfying things I've ever done, I think.
That's important to hear. You know, that's important for our audience to hear that stepping forward and joining in solidarity with Muslims under attack by the government has actually brought you some of the greatest happiness in your life.
Oh, absolutely. I have to say one thing was that the Muslim community has been very grateful to our support, and it has given me an entire community. I actually hang out more in mosques now than I do in churches. I'm a Catholic, and I go regularly to Mass, but we spend so much time in the mosque now, and I know so many of that community. I could literally go to give a talk in Detroit or Chicago, and I will meet people out there that I know. I couldn't do that in a Christian church. I don't know that many people. That's how enmeshed I've become with the Muslim community. What a wonderful community it is, and how generous and how caring they are. I've been incredibly enriched by that and by the families also, the families of the impacted families.
And people were surprised that the convictions went forward because it seems so clearly a setup.
Yes, I think they were. And I think actually the prosecution pulled out a lot of stops, and I want to talk for a little bit about that a little later on. I just want to get to the idea, the sense that these same tactics were being used all over the country.
Yes, they are.
And
here in Portland as well.
We got people from different other organizations to join ours and form Project Salaam. And we set up a database to try to track all these cases. And we now are following about 800 cases, I would say, of what we called preemptive prosecution.
800 cases?
Yeah.
That's bigger than I thought.
Yeah, it's very big. And what we described in preemptive prosecution was the notion that where somebody raises security concerns, where they appear suspicious for some reason, the government will create fake, phony, manufactured charges to get them convicted and locked up. And in that way, you're preempting them from actually engaging in any criminal conduct.
It's a very dangerous precedent because it's saying you don't have to have committed a crime to be arrested. It's going to thought crime.
That's right. And you are essentially saying we are willing to lock up hundreds of innocent people to prevent even one person from committing a crime. It's
complete. And in these cases, often
rejection, I think, of our criminal justice system.
Well, and specifically with this Malik, the informant there, but informants in many other cases have really harassed and worked hard to get people to commit crimes who otherwise would not have. They put a lot of time and a lot of money into these people that they're supposedly suspicious of. And I want you to talk now about what the FOIA releases, the recent FOIA release and what you found out, because these two men got convicted and they've been living under horrible conditions. And I would like you to touch on that, too, the CMUs that many of the Muslims who are convicted live in, the treatment they're receiving inside the federal prison system. But talk about, you know, after conviction, there was this Freedom of Information Act request filed in Arif's case.
Well, Arif, we went through the appeal process, and then after the appeal was over, he's been in jail now about 7 years, and maybe a year ago, he filed a FOIA request, and he got some documents back. We'd filed FOIA's request, he hadn't gotten anything back, but he got some documents back. But they were all redacted. You couldn't read any of them. But the one thing was that they didn't redact the labels. And the label on the files all said, to the effect, Yassin Arif, a.k.a. Mohammed Yassin, Al-Qaeda.
Ah.
Now, the a.k.a., also known as Mohammed Yassin, suggested that they thought that he was a Al-Qaeda agent named Mohammed Yassin and was using an alias. So there really was an al-Qaeda agent named Mohammed Yassin, and he was a very dangerous person. He specialized in making bombs. He'd blown two fingers off of one hand in the process, and he was eventually killed in Gaza in 2010. So if they had thought that he was Mohammed Yassin, we can show that they absolutely, for certain, were wrong. He was not Mohammed Yassin, because Yassin Arif is alive. Mohammed Yassin is dead, and Yassin Arif has got both fingers on his hand.
So we can prove that he's not who it is, but you did say that there was evidence that the court had seen these, the judge had seen these same papers.
Right. Well, what happened was, and I'll just describe the appeal. On the appeal, we filed our brief, and we had any number of issues that should have been, under normal circumstances, resulted in a mistrial or dismissal of the charges. We had a very strong case because there was literally no evidence against him.
And as a former chief attorney for the New York, I want to just date in here. This is Stephen Downs, a retired chief attorney with the New York Commission on Judicial Conduct. So you know from where you're talking about whether these things rose to the level of evidence or not.
Oh, sure. Well, anyway, we filed our brief. Then the government filed their brief. Then the government filed a secret brief that we weren't allowed to see. Then the government filed a top secret brief that was so secret that even the prosecutor wasn't allowed to see it, the local prosecutor. Then we went in and we had an oral argument before the Second Circuit. Then we were excused and the government went in and had a secret argument before the court. Now, you remember, this was a sting. Everything was tape recorded. Everything is videotaped. It was all shown to the jury. What was the secret issue that had to be told to the court? And clearly, it's obvious to us, the secret issue was the fact that this guy was, they believed, an al-Qaeda agent named Mohammed Yassin. And we believe they gave this false information to the court and said, in effect, sure, this may be a preemptive prosecution, maybe there's no evidence here, but we have an enemy agent here that we're trying to lock up, and you've got to help us.
And this is not uncommon in these cases either, is that they have secret evidence that the defense can't see, the defendant himself can't defend against because he doesn't know what's in them. And now I didn't realize that very often the prosecutor wouldn't know. It is a way of poisoning the judicial perspective, if what you want to say. And it's a common tactic that police will use with other people when they want to convince people to become informants. They will show them information and say, see this person? They've done this horrible thing. You've got to help us. It doesn't matter if it's false, what they're showing.
That's exactly right. And you go back, it goes back to COINTELPRO, if you remember the time back in the counterintelligence program that the FBI used to go after Black Panthers and Indian National Movement and peace activists. And they would use the same tactics. They would lie. They would make up false stories. They even participated in assassinations of key Muslim of key African-American leaders. All of these things were done back then. There was a period of time which the Church Committee, if you recall, denounced these tactics, said it was absolutely unforgivable. You could not do this in a democratic society where the government was essentially making war on its own citizens. But then once 9/11 came, all of the restrictions came off, and the government went right back to doing COINTELPRO.
And with this particular case, somewhere early in it, the government announced that it was a National Security Agency surveillance had aided them in this case. One of the first times they'd come out and said that. And with the recent revelations about how widespread NSA spying is, they want you to think, well, we'll get it right. We'll know what we're talking about. We'll get it right, and we'll follow the law, and the people we target are the right people. But here we know that they at some point realized that this was not the same man.
Right.
Is that accurate? I mean, yes. For one thing, he didn't have two fingers blown off.
Right. I'm sure they must now at this point realize that he's not the same man, but the government never admits their mistakes. They simply don't do it. One of the things they did was they took him out of the CMU right about the time that Mohammed Yassin, the bomb maker, died in Gaza. They took Yassin Arif out of the CMU and moved him into a low-security prison in Pennsylvania.
And
it was a kind of a whoops, sorry, you know, well, we're not going to admit that we're wrong, but we'll move you down here to the low security section.
Interesting. And also, Hossein is in a medium security prison, so they call them super dangerous. But I want to talk just really briefly. We don't have a whole lot of moments, but the CMU units, these are federal solitary units. Can you talk about what happens to people like Yassin in solitary?
Sure.
You met him one time when he had been in solitary.
I've been on several times at the CMUs, yeah. These are not exactly solitary. The places like Supermax in Colorado would be a solitary unit where everybody was in solitary. In the CMUs, they treat the whole prison as one big solitary cell. In other words, they are free to move within that, but they don't. What they're trying to do is cut off communication. All of these prosecutions, preemptive prosecutions, are ideological prosecutions. They're prosecuting people because of their ideology makes them suspicious. And they want to quarantine that ideology in these prisons, so they make it very, very difficult to communicate with the outside world. That's their primary function. You journalists just never get in there.
And people, also families, people can't touch them. It's through plexiglass. Is that correct?
That's right. And everything is monitored.
And so when you have a family, your children can come and see you, but they can't touch you.
That's right. And I took the kids out there to see Yassin. We drove 2 days out and 2 days back. It was a total of a five-day trip. We got out there. We were spending about half. It was supposed to be a long visit, but we spent about a half hour with him. And I took out a pen to write something down. And they immediately rushed in and threw us out of the jail.
Oh, my goodness.
On the grounds. And I had a secret recording device. The pen was a secret recording device. And that was how sensitive they were about any word getting out of the jail. They did not want even anybody writing anything or recording anything.
And these CMUs
are driven 2 days to get there.
Yeah, and these and think if you have support and other people around you. Think if you were the only just the family member who had traveled that hard to get there and ran into that kind of experience. Yassin is also a poet. I want to tell our audience that I've got some links on our website, and you can click on those links, and I think one of them will take you to a place where you can see some of his poetry. So what's happening now is that you're filing an appeal, and there's a bunch of community actions that are about to happen in the public, and I do want to let our audience know about those events and also what they can do to support Yassin Arif and resist our government's, these preemptive lockups. But this one, he's convicted, but he's convicted unfairly, and it's pretty easy to see.
Yes. This one is a very easy one. And everybody who looks at it says, yeah, there's something really wrong here. We're going to file this, what's called a 2255, which requests the court to review the matter based on new evidence. And the problem, of course, is that the courts always look at the secret evidence and they don't give any evaluation to new material because the new material does not really affect their judgment. Their judgment is based entirely on the secret evidence, which is that this guy's an Al-Qaeda agent, even though it's wrong because the government never takes it back. So what we're trying to do is raise the profile of this case so that the government will actually, the courts will actually take it seriously and call for the government to account for the lies we believe that were told to the court about who Yassin Arif is.
Now, you have an online petition going, don't you?
Yes, we have an online petition going, and we'd like people to come in and sign that. And if they want to, it's on our Project Salaam website. That's www.projectsalaam.org.
And when you go to our website and to the today's schedule where it talks about this, there is a link that you can click on that will take you to Project Salaam, I believe. I will also put a link up. Change.org has a petition there under a victim of Muslim identity that people can sign and take action on. You know, Stephen, we're already out of town, and there was And there's so much more that I wanted to talk to you about building the community support you have. It's something here in Portland we could learn from how Albany has acted. I want to thank you very much, Stephen Downs, attorney for Yassin Arif, a victim of mistaken identity locked in federal prison by our government. Thank you so much for joining us today.
thank you, Linda. I really appreciate you having me on.
You're welcome. And for you out there, you can go to change.org and look for A Victim of Mistaken Identity or to Project Salon. Find those links on our website. I want to thank all of you for tuning in and listening to KBOO and to A Deeper Look today. And I want to thank our engineer, Rock.
And it is a minute now before 10 o'clock. Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up in 15 minutes on Flashpoint, writer and activist Kevin Gray discusses the Supreme Court decision to cut a key aspect of the landmark 1965 Voting Rights Act. He also weighs in on the George Zimmerman trial for the murder of teen Trayvon Martin. Also, at 11 today on Between the Covers, host David Naiman interviews Noviolent Bulawayo about her new novel of Africa called We Need New Names. And then at 11:30, The Film Show features news and interviews about the independent film scene in Portland. But first, it's Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. And that's coming up next on KBOO.
Tune in to Between the Covers every Thursday at 11 a.m. to hear interviews with locally and nationally known authors from both fiction and nonfiction. Between the Covers, only on KBOO Portland.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Thursday, June 27th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Oregon is slashing the 2014 health insurance premium request by as much as 35% in some cases. A federal judge yesterday ordered the U.S. Bureau of Land Management to sell more timber in southern Oregon. And it also vacated a system federal scientists use to avoid harming the northern spotted owl. Let me just run that by you again. The federal judge yesterday vacated. That means tossed out.